on your MacBook Pro Max delivery?
Sadly, no. It's still, unfortunately, the November 19th, 26th date. I was hoping they might do the thing where they do quite a lot, where when there's a lot of demand stuff, they kind of ramp up the production and then stuff comes sooner. But you know what the climate is at the moment. We can't even get groceries. we can get them, but like half the stuff is like replaced or substituted. It's, I don't know, the whole world's a bit out of supply, it feels like, and my laptop's in that state at the moment. So November 19th, probably another like three shows worth of happy hour before I have one. But
and you're still using your 2016 15-inch MacBook Pro, is that right?
That is correct, yeah. It is barely holding in there.
You may be the last person to use one on Earth.
I know, and I can't even upgrade to Monterey because Xcode's busted, so I'm just stuck.
What's wrong with Xcode?
Well, Xcode 13 on this laptop runs terribly, and it's not just this laptop, it's like other ones that aren't like newish. And Monterey doesn't run Xcode 12, so I have to stay on Xcode 12, I have to stay on Big Sur, so I can't upgrade to Monterey either. So I'm just going to run the 2016 laptop on Big Sur until my new one comes, obviously, but... Mm. Just holding it out, you know, feeling like an ancient person for a change. Because normally this is like the first time I haven't updated my Mac OS on day one, so I just feel like out of it. It's really annoying, but I don't have another choice.
Yeah, and you're even getting kind of removed from the hype of the MacBook Pro launch. Like when it comes to you, it'll be new to you, but it's not. It's kind of like settling in now.
Well, yeah, I mean, I feel like I've vicariously heard the experiences through everybody else apart from me, but. I mean, I ordered that machine. I'm not changing it. I'll just ride it out, you know?
Well, let me tell you about my experience.
Oh, dear. What's happened, dude?
Yeah. No, I didn't buy one or anything, but okay. I was traveling over the weekend with my SpaceX board colleague, Daryl Sasse, and he has a fairly maxed out 16-inch MacBook Pro with the M1 Max chip, and I got to handle it a little bit, you know? Hold it, open it. Go to Safari, browse the web, see the screen, see the notch, you know, change modes, kind of get a sense of the heft of it and everything. So it was just enough to excite me and get it out of my system.
Was it nice?
So it's a nice machine. I think you have to need it, you know?
Yeah, I mean, like, based on obviously, just what I've read from people left, right, and center, the day-to-day experience of using the computer is not that different from using an M1 machine, right? So if you're just doing, like, if you're not using the extra core power or the extra RAM or the extra graphics power, it basically feels like a MacBook Air, right?
Yeah, I love the clarity in that, by the way, that it's clear if you which you need at this point.
Yeah, for sure. Like, it's... And this isn't a denigration of the pros or it's just the base machines are really good and Apple's M1 cores are really fast, and if all you need is web browsing and, you know, Twitter and stuff like that, you can probably get away with a base model MacBook Air, and the experience between that and a MacBook Pro doing that task is, you know, largely the same, obviously ignoring stuff like the bigger screen or the screen quality. You know, mini LED obviously makes a difference, but you know, the base level computing power is identical. It's you have to do some pretty intensive tasks because the raw M1 cores are as fast as most Intel machines of the last 5 years, you know? Like, only the higher spec 16-inch models would even beat the M1 when we were talking about this a year ago, right? So for the M1 Pro and the M1 Max, you really have to go up the echelons of computing, you know, doing stuff like Xcode or photos or video in a serious way for it to actually... you know, matter, which is why I keep telling you not to buy one and wait it out for like an iMac upgrade or something, because I just know that that'd be more suited for you and what you have at the moment, which is an M1 24-inch iMac, right? Like, that does everything you need to do, and if you replaced it with one of these, you probably wouldn't even know. Like, if you could just change the guts of your iMac to put an M1 Pro in there instead, there's a good chance you wouldn't even know, you know? Like, the actual day-to-day experience is probably going to be the same. And actually, the M1 Pro and M1 Max have two less efficiency cores than what the M1 does. So in some ways, if you're only doing light tasks, you're almost better off not getting them, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, I actually am at the point right now where the higher end iMac that's going to come, you know, eventually, I don't I'm not like super tempted by it in the way that I might have been before. Because I know it'll be like pricey in the way that, like, I look at that iMac as like the iMac version of these MacBook Pros. And in the way that I think a MacBook Air is better suited for me than these MacBook Pros are, that will probably also be true of the iMacs. And, you know, it's a lot of it is things I've discussed over the year, you know, past year, where like I'm not editing the podcast myself anymore, and I'm not doing, you know, really anything heavily intensive at all anymore. It's writing, it's light photo editing, and you know, it's using a computer for like basic computer things, but nothing that the M1 chip can't handle, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's why you kind of got away with working from an iPad for a while.
Exactly. Yeah.
Really, the horizon of Apple products is more focused on like the M2 MacBook Air, right? Like
what's already out is plenty for me right now. Yeah.
Yeah, but down the road, your temptations.
What do you think? Like, what would an M2 do? Because I mean, I guess it's better at being we would not expect an M2 base to be more performant than an M1 Pro or M1 Max. It'll just have fewer cores and just lower everything. But what determines an M2? Like, it's just the next size and chip, or it's the, you know, it's like going from an A13 to an A14 kind of change.
Yeah, like you'll get faster cores probably. You might get, they might be able to add like more RAM. So if you just wanted more RAM on the lower end spec, you might be able to get that. But I was thinking more like not necessarily the chip, just like the design. They'll probably have it, you know, good, like what they did from the 13-inch MacBook Pro to the 14-inch, right? Mm-hmm. You'll probably get like a nicer looking machine, maybe thinner, pretty colors, better screen quality, better webcam, that kind of thing. Like, I don't think they'll put like the ProMotion Mini panel on the next MacBook Air, but maybe they'll give it like thinner bezels, you know, maybe they'll have a notch for the camera and stuff. So it will look a lot more modern, right? But it, in terms of raw computing performance, yeah, I mean, what you've got now isn't going to change too much.
Yeah, and because going from like one iPhone to the next iPhone or one iPad to the next iPad, even when they skip chips, it's not a humongous performance improvement. And so I think it's fair to assume the same thing for Macs. And so if the current Mac chips can do things that you need, then waiting for the next one, specifically the Air, it's the design that I would expect to be the kicker and versus the performance. So.
Yeah, like in terms of the design, in terms of performance cliffs, like the transition to Apple Silicon is where you're seeing the big change, right? So the first round of MacBook Air was way, way faster than the old MacBook Air, and this new generation MacBook Pro is way faster than like the high-end Intel MacBook Pros of the same generation, and even more so on graphics. But I don't expect the next update to this MacBook Pro to be substantially better. Like maybe it goes from 10 cores to 12 cores and then each core slightly faster, but you're not going to see another step change like you did with the transition as we've seen over the last year. Like you'll get it for the higher end iMac and you get it for the Mac Pro when those transition to Apple Silicon, but for the current laptops that are out now, I think we're going to be like coasting for a while, because what are they going to add to the next generation MacBook Pro that isn't just like, you know, 10% faster, which is immaterial in the scheme of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, in my handling of the 16-inch MacBook Pro, my colleague Daryl's MacBook Pro, he has this space gray model. I really did just enjoy like flipping it around on my hands, not like in the air, but like, you know, rotating it and just kind of feeling the different shape of it all. And then, you know, put it on the table, open it up, like watch some video and see how the screen looks and everything. Try to determine how much of an impact the notch is and everything. And it's just like so subtle that for me, it was, well, try and find the notch, because in so many cases the OS blends it in or doesn't put content around it, you know. So it, you know, without using it for more than like say like 20 minutes, it just felt like using a MacBook. But if you know all the problems of like say the pre 16-inch MacBook Pro, then it's, you know, really refreshing to have this thing and then the additional ports and everything. But one of the things that I wasn't so clear on was the ProMotion stuff. And so we talked a little bit about this before, but it's that ProMotion on the iPad and the iPhone, it's pretty clear, you know, right for me, like right from the launch screen animations, it's, oh, wow, that's a lot smoother. It feels faster, but it's the same speed because it's just so much smoother. On the Mac, I didn't quite have that experience. I'm not sure I would have noticed if I didn't know it was there. You know, I'm not sure I did notice actually. So, and what I was doing. So, it's just less of an impact. And there's a reason for that, right?
Yeah, so we did talk about this slightly last week, because this, like, when we recorded last week's episode, I was like researching this, and then I posted it like the day after. But basically, the Mac situation, and a few weeks ahead of the Unleashed event, I was like, when that 120 hertz rumor was going around, I said, I'm skeptical because I don't think macOS is really prepared to handle 120 yet. And they obviously did 120, but I was essentially correct in that the operating system is not ready in the same way, like at the lower levels, to run and adapt smoothly like iOS is. So currently, if you're using like the Finder, so if you're just dragging like Finder windows around, it'll be 120. If you're doing like animations inside of apps, most of those would be 120. But the big thing that people want promotions for is for scrolling, right? Like, that's where you see the biggest difference on like an iPhone or iPad, and ideally on the Mac too. But as it stands at the moment, the like AppKit layer that handles scrolling is just not finished to handle 120 as you would expect. As it, like on the iPhone, as your finger touches the screen, it's immediately changing the refresh rate of the display as you scroll, right? Like and on the iPad, it's basically 120 constantly, apart from when you're watching set FPS content, like a video or something, when it ramps down. On the Mac, a lot of the animations in the system are like coded from 10 years ago, and they haven't been updated, so they still just run at the 60 hertz resolution. If you run a Mac connected to a external display that's higher refresh rate, it does run at that fixed refresh rate. What seems to be happening on these MacBook Pros is because the screen is adaptive and it can, you know, go up and down from 24 up to 120, that most of the older code doesn't notice that it can go up to 120, and it just carries on doing it like the old native rate of 60, if that makes sense. So unfortunately, if you're like scrolling Safari at the moment, you might get like 120. The trackpad will track your motion at 120, but like as soon as you let go of the trackpad, so because a lot of, like a pretty natural scroll gesture on any device these days is because you have inertial scrolling, you just kind of put your fingers down and you flick it, right? Well, while your fingers are connected to the trackpad, that motion up and down, it's probably going to render, you know, close to 120 refresh rate, and even in Safari. But as soon as you let go and it's doing that kind of like inertial animation of the scroll, that's rendering at 60. So the big impact of promotion isn't really being realized yet on the Mac. There's nothing, the hardware obviously supports it. If you virtualize Windows, you can see 120 because that's kind of equivalent to doing the external display trick. But in terms of just actually using native Mac apps, we have to wait for Apple to issue an update. And actually, do you remember the whole furore about promotion on the iPhone 13 Pro with third-party apps? And they promised that they were going to... In that case, Apple actually responded, and they said, here's some more developer documentation, and we have a software update planned to fix some bugs relating to this. Well, actually, as of the current betas, the issues described in that September situation still haven't been addressed. So we're still actually waiting for the promotion fix on the iPhone. And on the Mac, we're obviously now waiting for an update, but they haven't even promised there's going to be one. But I hope they do, because it's just, otherwise it's just a waste of some, you know, really nice screen hardware. And similarly, I hope they have a better fix for the notch situation when you're in those cases where you have like a million menu items, and, you know, they should add scrolling or something just to tidy it up. Like, when you're paying, you know, top premium prices for these laptops, you want the whole experience to be perfect, and there's no excuse for Apple not to make it so. So I hope this stuff's coming. Some people say that even the current macOS 12.1 beta handles some of this stuff a bit better, but, you know, we'll see obviously when it comes out. But maybe by the time my machine actually arrives, all these problems will be fixed.
That's right.
Unlikely, but I can hope. Happy Hour this week is brought to you by BetterHelp. Do you feel strained or just not as happy as you do normally? We all know it's been a stressful couple of years. Is there something maybe preventing you from achieving your goals? Sometimes you just want someone to talk to who is trained about mental health and lifestyle. And BetterHelp is quite literally here to help from the comfort of your own home. BetterHelp assesses your needs to match you with a licensed professional therapist tailored to helping your personal well-being. Simply connect in a safe and crucially private online environment. After signing up, you can start communicating to a therapist in under 48 hours. This is not run-of-the-mill self-help. This is professional counseling done securely online. And you can access counselors specialized in all sorts of areas like stress, anger, relationships, depression, and sleep. And you can start a conversation with your therapist at your convenience. You just send them a message. The therapist will respond in a timely manner, and you can also schedule sessions like weekly video chats or phone calls too if you want to. BetterHelp is more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and financial aid options are available. And of course, everything that you talk about is 100% private and confidential. So start living a happier life today. As a listener to this show, you can get 10% off your first month by visiting our sponsor at betterhelp.com/machappyhour. Join over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health. Again, that's BetterHelp, spelt BetterHelp.com/machappyhour. Thanks to BetterHelp for sponsoring the show.
All right. Also new this past week is that the HomePod Mini in 3D colors, blue, yellow, and orange, are now in stores, in Apple stores. I was looking today locally at Best Buy around me. You can order them for 5 days out, but there's none in stores yet for pickup. But people have these. People have the new colorful HomePod Minis in the wild. And I don't know. They look pretty cool. The packaging's really nice. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, what is there to say? Look, it's a HomePod Mini in new colors. Orange, red, and blue. I mean, I think it's nice. I kind of wish Apple would concentrate on expanding the HomePod lineup in other ways, i.e. bringing back the big one so we don't just have a Mini anymore. But color-wise, I think the red one looks pretty cool. Although it's really like orange, but kind of reddish.
You're saying, I think you said orange, red, and blue. So it's orange, yellow, and blue. And the orange is what? The box is like straight up red, but then...
Yeah, that's what I was getting confused. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's weird they chose to do orange and yellow when they could have gone like more diverse on the color spectrum, maybe it's like a green or something. But the orange one basically looks red, at least on the box. But the actual like HomePod Mini itself is still orange.
Yeah, it has the classic problem too of YouTube always like oversaturate, well, not YouTube itself, but like creators often super saturate colors, and so they just do not look the same as they look in real life. So it's often, you know, YouTube's a poor barometer for what color is this iPhone or HomePod in this case. I guess the bigger thing with HomePod Mini right now is that, you know, it's the holiday quarter. So by having more color options, and if you've already got one, you know, you got a couple of them, this is maybe there's an incentive to add to the collection, or, you know, it's to gift to somebody else. And, you know, the more HomePod adoption there is, whether it's big HomePod, you know, gone, or HomePod Mini now, the better it is. You know, if their sales are better for HomePod Mini for Apple, then the experience will get better for customers because they'll see people are interested in it and keep it going.
Yeah, and I don't want to spend forever on Apple earnings, but we did miss them last week because of the recording schedule. But basically, Apple had earnings last week. They announced, I don't know, some crazy record again, like $83.5 billion in revenue. All their product categories were up. The big thing of this quarter was that Apple said they would have made an extra $6 billion in revenue had there not been supply chain issues. So basically, instead of realizing $83 billion in revenue, they would have realized close to $90 billion. The stock dropped off a little bit after they said the news, because also they warned that in the holiday quarter, i.e. the current months, October, November, December, they're also going to face supply constraints that are going to impact their bottom line greater than $6 billion. So obviously we talked a bit about the supply chain issues at the start of the show, but Apple is definitely incurring the brunt of them at the moment across all of their products, seemingly. There was even a report this week that Apple's redirecting iPad production lines and iPad chip production lines in order to prioritize the iPhone. So to keep, obviously they want to keep their main product, the most profitable product, going. So the iPhone 13 is the priority, but everything else from, you know, iPhone and iPad and Mac, it's all getting hit by production constraints. And Apple basically says like, yep, we're having these issues. We think they'll ease over time, but short term, we're seeing, you know, literal billions of dollars in missed revenue because we can't actually sell these things.
Yeah, yeah. Not unique to Apple.
Yeah, not unique, you know, to Apple, indeed. It's like all these companies are having production issues, but obviously Apple's the biggest company in the world. And so in absolute terms, they get hit the worst, I guess. Also new this week, there was an interesting report from the Wall Street Journal that Apple has been testing a new feature for both the iPhone and the Apple Watch that will actually help people detect car crashes. So, you know, Apple's obviously has CarPlay, but this is separate. It would just be if your iPhone's in your pocket or your watch is on your wrist, it would be measuring for a sudden spike in gravity change or G-forces, essentially allowing for the watch or the phone to detect that you've been involved in a serious accident in a car. I think what's interesting about this is, like, as the iPhone matures, they're kind of, the more features they add, they're not like features of the iPhone. They're just like features that help you in the rest of your life. It is an iPhone feature and the iPhone's doing the tracking, but it's not like something that you do on your phone. It's just like the iPhone's the kind of like the ambient data collection, and it can help you out in an instant. And we've seen Apple's interest in this in, you know, a few different areas. Obviously, they've done fall detection on the watch before. There were the rumors that they're working on the satellite stuff to be able to contact people in emergencies. And this car crash thing is kind of the latest line in that. So the idea is that Apple's already been doing this anonymously. So apparently Apple's been testing the crash detection feature. They've collected data, and it basically shows that Apple could have already recorded more than 10 million suspected vehicle impacts based on their research. So apparently this feature is going to be set for release sometime in 2022, probably part of like iOS 16 and WatchOS 9.
You've already seen the experience of someone having a car accident and having the Apple Watch detect not detect but be available as SOS, so the phone gets dislodged from, you know, reach, and the watch is there, and the driver can squeeze the side button and it calls 911. That's literally been an Apple ad because it was a real life experience. I like the idea of taking something that is useful, sort of that you do manually, making it more automatic. So you've got like fall detection, but you have SOS, and those are on the watch, and SOS is on the phone. But there's nothing automatic about the experience of the car accident. What do you do then? So it's a logical feature, and also great to be on not just on the watch but on the phone, because it hits a much bigger audience. As you were mentioning, that there's already a bit of this going on in terms of just research. Like you could see maps data being a part of it. You know, you already see like what traffic, you know, where traffic is built up based on iPhone users and that kind of thing. So you could see that being a factor.
It actually says in this story that Apple's been, I don't know what subset of the user base like agrees to do this. I don't know what feature when you're improving Apple Maps or improving everywhere else that relates into this, but the Wall Street Journal says that Apple's been correlating the motion data from the phone with 911 call data. So i.e. when the iPhone record, when someone on the phone like actually calls manually, Apple's been cross-referencing the collected data from the device to then say, oh, to give a higher confidence rating that this particular like movement signature corresponds to a car crash. So they're doing like live in the field analysis of it, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, it's pretty clever. You can imagine, as hard as it is to have the fall detection feature on the Apple Watch not give you too many false positives where it thinks that you've fallen but you actually haven't, that would be even harder in driving conditions, because there is, you know, stopping abruptly and then there's actually being in a car accident. And you don't want to do the thing on the iPhone where the watch says, you know, here's a countdown, respond to it, or we're going to call emergency services. Because if that happens too many times on the iPhone while you're driving for car crash detection, then you're just going to turn off the feature because it becomes distracting.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been, you know, various controversies over the last few years that the SOS feature is too easy to activate on the iPhone as it is. And 911 centers have been like deluded with phone calls from people accidentally calling 911 through their watch. And, you know, Apple's gone back and forth with them talking about various mitigations. And actually in the latest iOS 15 betas, they've actually changed they've given you a new option for the way that you actually activate the SOS feature on the watch or the phone, probably somewhat related to that. So yeah, they're definitely doing a lot of investment in this kind of whole, like, you know, fall detection, crash detection, you're having an accident, or to, you know, helpfulness. There's a lot of development going on in that area from Apple's perspective. Happy Hour this week is also brought to you by ExpressVPN. Going online with ExpressVPN is like taking a call on a train on speakerphone for everyone to hear. You don't want everyone around you to know about your personal conversations, and it's the same when browsing online. By default, all of your internet traffic at home is going through your internet service provider, and that means your ISP knows every single website that you visit, and then they sell this information on to ad companies and tech giants to use their data to target ads and track you around the web. So you need a VPN to stop this, and ExpressVPN is the best of the bunch. When you browse with ExpressVPN, all of your network traffic is going over a secure, encrypted tunnel. Nobody in between can see your data, and your IP address is masked. It's super secure. and that means your ISP can't see or sell your online activity anymore. All of the security does not come at the expense of performance, because ExpressVPN is also super fast. A lot of the cheaper VPN services out there, where they cut down your internet speed when you're using them to save money on their servers, but ExpressVPN remains super fast, so you can stream HD video without buffering whilst browsing securely. To enable ExpressVPN, it just takes a single click. You download the app, you click to connect, and boom, instantly 100% of your network data is secure. And it works on all your devices, from phones to laptops, iPads, and more. ExpressVPN is rated the number one choice by CNET and TechRadar. I've used ExpressVPN, and it really is so effortless to use. You literally just click one button, and you can get on with what you're doing in the knowledge that all of your internet data and traffic is protected. And you can even use it to get around geographic content blocks on pesky websites that just won't let you see what's there because of where you live. And as someone that lives inside of the EU, this happens so much. There's still so many it's kind of insane. There's so many websites that are like American hosted that still haven't complied with GDPR or got the licensing for it. So you just visit their website and it says, we can't help you right now. But with ExpressVPN, you can, you know, essentially change your location so you can still see what's going on there. You can still see the content. So whether you're doing it for security or you're doing it for content access, as we're all traveling around more, ExpressVPN whilst you're out and about is just so useful. Secure your online activity today by visiting expressvpn.com/happyhour. That's expressvpn.com/happyhour, and you can get an extra 3 months for free. One more time, expressvpn.com/happyhour.
All right, next up is Craig Federighi, who we know from Apple, from WWDC, of presenting what's new in iOS and what's new in macOS, et cetera, for the year. Craig is in charge of software, you know, the OSs at Apple. But this week, Apple's had him giving a public appearance, not about what's new and coming, but more to drive a message. And this is at the Web Summit, and specifically he's tasked with speaking about the dangers of sideloading software on iOS. And this is sort of in response to legislative changes, to regulatory changes happening, and meant to just deliver a message from Apple to the people who may have some influence, I suppose. So what did Craig say, and what's your take on what's going on here?
Yeah, so we've seen this happen a bit in the US as well. Like, Apple keeps releasing those like white papers with all the funny diagrams of like foxes representing thieves and whatnot about iPhone security. This one is obviously more focused towards what's going on in Europe and the European Union, because this Web Summit conference takes place in Lisbon inside of Europe. And specifically, Federighi is kind of pushing against some of the proposals in the Digital Markets Act, which was actually unveiled about a year ago now. And I mean, Apple wouldn't send Craig Federighi to some random tech conference in Portugal if they didn't think this was a serious threat, right? Like, they don't want the stuff inside the Digital Markets Act to happen, but clearly they think it might. They think it very well might. Like, you don't see Apple SVPs or CEOs just turning up at very many tech conferences on a whim. Like, this is obviously very well prepared and calculated. And there are parts of the Digital Markets Act that Apple agrees with, like the privacy stuff. But one of the kind of leading principles of it is to break down competition, to open up competition in the big tech platforms, basically meaning that tech platforms can't monopolize their own platforms as far as apps go, and that includes allowing sideloading on the iPhone. This is something that obviously Apple doesn't want, and Federighi kind of like posed a few reasons in this presentation, talking about obviously like why it's more secure, gave some examples of recent compromises on Android and other platforms. Like, he gave the propaganda speech, right? Everything you'd expect to see. It's only like 10 minutes long. It's worth a watch. You can find it on YouTube. One of the things he did say, though, was like, He was kind of pushing back against the comment that, you know, what's the harm in offering sideloading? Because why don't you let people choose, and they can choose whether they want freedom or they can choose to have a more safer experience? And basically, Craig's argument is that, like, even if you have no intention of doing it, criminals will coerce or deceive you into doing so. And he gave an example recently of a COVID-19 tracker app that was emailed around in Germany, basically saying, download this app and you can find out about COVID-19 in your area. Well, it turned out that the COVID-19 app required you to download off the app, off the Google Play Store, and it wasn't actually a COVID-19 app at all. It was just a conveyor for malware, and it would lock your phone, and it'd be like ransomware, and you have to pay a load of money to get access to your device again. So like a very, you know, poignant case that's obviously relevant to common culture. And he also kind of said that even if you yourself have a high level of awareness and you're going to perceive every threat, you know, the presence of sideloading endangers your family and your friends and your children, really pulling on the heartstrings. And also he made the point that, let's say a social networking app, because of, you know, the freedom now to offer by sideloading, they take themselves out of the app store. In that case, your only choice is to sideload the app, i.e. giving up the, you know, supposed or real security benefits of the app store to keep in touch with your friends and family, right? And clearly he's alluding to Facebook here, because, you know, big tech platforms like Facebook and Twitter and TikTok and Instagram, they have, you know, good incentives to leave the app store closed garden, walled garden, if they were able to just be downloaded like a website through the internet. However, there is like something that goes unsaid in what Craig's going on here, is that maybe the social networking app wants to leave the App Store partly because it doesn't agree with App Store policy around privacy or whatever else, and they want to serve better ads at you. But another reason is just because, you know, Apple's the one imposing pretty onerous financial terms on them, where if they want to do in-app purchasing, they have to give 15-30% over to Apple. So, like, you know, if Federighi and Apple cared so much about customer trust and privacy and safety, they could get rid of the financial disincentives for those apps to sideload in the first place, right? Like, and obviously Federighi doesn't touch on that point, but it's definitely like the big counter. And like, that's kind of my response to this whole thing, is like the effective change of allowing sideloading, it's not as dangerous as what Apple, you know, pits it to be in these presentations. It's not zero. Like, a device that is closed off to everything but the App Store versus something that you can download anything from the web, you know, by definition, it's going to be more secure if it's through the App Store. And I think we've seen over the course of history that Apple's done a decent job at controlling the App Store. We always hear about the exceptional cases, right? And there's probably more of them than there should be. But in general, it's going to be a better status quo than the Wild Wide Web. And I personally think that the iPhone would be a better product if it doesn't have sideloading, it doesn't have all this like crap and junk and possibility for malware and viruses to come through, you know, arbitrary downloads on the web. However, as like a, you know, a pundit or a critic or whatever you want to say, like, it's hard for Apple to take that position when they're also just benefiting, you know, on the scale of billions and billions of dollars financially from making that so, right? Like, their decision at the or their position not to allow sideloading on the phone isn't just a byproduct of their position on user safety and privacy. It's also just the cynical fact that they make a load of money by making the App Store a monopoly. So they can keep coming out to all these conferences and, you know, appeal to governments about this stuff. But I think if they actually want to make, like, if they actually want to get people on side, and if they actually want to make people, you know, see their point of view, because his argument was basically like, as Apple, we should be allowed to give users the choice of an entirely safe and wholly protected system, i.e. the iPhone without sideloading, the App Store only, and customers can choose whether they want the iPhone or they want other platforms like Android that do offer sideloading to some extent. But even on this presentation, Federighi was saying that, you know, on Android, Google disallows or highly discourages sideloading from happening by putting up warnings and dialogues to kind of turn people off from doing it. But you can eventually do it. But even in those cases, people are still fooled and deceived, and bad stuff happens. So, like, although he's obviously, you know, cares about his platform the most, he was still saying that, you know, he thinks it's bad for Android too. But basically, Apple wants the right to choose for their own customers, and then customers can choose to go to a different phone if they want to. I think all of what he said is perfectly fine, right? Some of it's a bit over-exaggerated compared to reality, but if they actually want to get this stuff, you know, taken away and taken out of these acts, they have to break down the financial incentives that Apple also gets by enforcing it. Like, they have to make it just a privacy and customer safety thing, and not a thing that does that, but, you know, on the side really ensures that you can carry on making billions of dollars off in-app game purchases. I don't know if you have any position on this.
my only thing to say is, what do you think? What do you think is more fun for Federighi to say to present the Safari redesign from WWDC or this?
That's funny. Like,
yeah, it's these are the last two things that he's had to do publicly. So
I did know that on this presentation they use screenshots of Safari in compact mode. So.
That's the way
based
I use
in this
the,
presentation. Maybe that's what Craig uses. He's sticking to it. It's like, I don't care what everyone else complains about. That's what I'm going to use. I'm going to use compact mode with the you know, with the bubbly tabs.
Yeah, yeah. I guess the big picture is, you know, just the fact that Apple's sending people out to talk about these things at conferences. But you know, it's what's going to happen is going to happen, and it's we'll see. But
yeah, and Apple's not doing. Apple shouldn't get too much sympathy because they're trying to claw onto all of this revenue at the same time. Like,
yes,
Facebook would have no disincentive. Facebook would have no reason to leave the App Store if they could freely charge whatever they wanted and keep all the money. Like, the only reason side loading has come up as a thing that as like a release valve is because Apple's so maniacal and controlling of the App Store itself and making all the money, you know, taking the 30% cut. Like, the 30% cut is the reason the Digital Markets Act has come around in the first place. Like, if Apple had been less stingy on the financial side, they wouldn't have to worry about risking customer safety in the first place. So, like, it's the way, obviously, that Apple presents it in the PR perspective is that this is something being, like, bestowed onto them that they don't want. But, you know, they're part of the problem. It's just different. It's just a different aspect of it. Kind of related to this, remember in South Korea that basically it's now law that app stores have to offer alternate payment systems. Well, Apple's like appealing or whatever, but Google said they're complying, and they actually announced the first changes to their policy today. And rather amusingly, Google says that, yes, if you're in the Google Play Store, you are allowed to offer alternatives to the Google Play payment system. However, we still want a cut. So if you use a third-party payment system on an app distributed by the Google Play Store, whatever you buy, Google wants an 11% cut. That's down from like the 15 or 30%. They want 11%. So again, this is, you know, up to Google and Apple to make these policy decisions and up to the law to see if they're allowed or not. But we spoke about Apple doing this, right? That even if they were eventually forced to allow alternate payment methods, they still might want to try and collect commission. And Google's doing exactly that in Korea. They're saying, you can have an alternate payment system, but you have to give us 11% of the money. And that's like a 4% saving compared to what it would normally be. Because I think Google's going down to 15% flat. Sooner rather than later. So they're basically saying, if you want to use an alternate payment system, you can save 4% out of the total. So that's kind of a funny little gambit there that maybe Apple will copy down the road. Who knows?
Sign of things to come, yeah.
Yeah, and it harkens right back to that Epic trial where Tim Cook was like, you know, the judge asked him, why do you need to collect the 30% through in-app purchase? And Tim was like, well, if we didn't do that, we'd have to find a different way to collect our commission. We have to invoice them. And it just feels like a big process that doesn't need to exist, but we'd have to collect our commission at the end of the day. So, you know, making the money is disconnected from which payment system's used. And at least that's what Apple and Google are going to try to argue while these cases go on. Happy Hour this week is also brought to you by Mac Updater. Mac Updater is a simple Mac utility that scans your disks and finds all of your installed apps and works out if they need updating or not. And then you can update them all with just one click. So if you're like me and you have a lot of apps installed on your Mac that aren't from the Mac App Store, you can use Mac Updater to get the same unified software update experience as you get with Mac App Store apps, but with any app from the web. You can try out for free at corecode.io/happyhour. And if you don't want to update everything at once, you can click on each app inside of Mac Updater and it will pull in like the latest release notes and changes, so you can decide for yourself if you want to install the new version or not. And Mac Updater has version information for more than 60,000 apps, and the 6,000 most popular apps can be updated with a single click. Mac Updater can be used as a standalone app or from the menu bar. I tried it out and I was genuinely impressed. Like, the scan was really fast and it told me about outdated apps that honestly I had forgotten I'd installed on my laptop at all. Mac Updater can be tried for free. It's a one-time purchase to unlock all features, which adds support for audio plugins, preference panes, quick look plugins, and more. One-time purchase, no subscription required. And new in the just-released 2.1 version, Mac Updater has added support for even more software types, including Adobe plugins, integration with Alfred, like the Spotlight equivalent, if you use that, improved performance, and full compatibility with macOS Monterey. They've even added an icon option, so if you don't like the Big Sur icon style, you can switch back to the classic look because their customers asked for it. So they really sweat the details like that. You can download Mac Updater today for free at corecode.io/happyhour. And when you're ready to buy the full version, you can get 10% off using our promo code HAPPYHOURQ3. Once again, that's corecode.io/MacUpdater and use promo code HAPPYHOURQ3, HAPPYHOURQ3, when you buy. Thanks to MacUpdater for sponsoring the show.
All right, next up is this development from Netflix, which you may know as the movie and TV show streaming service. And they are sort of joining Mini in tech and offering some sort of gaming service, not unlike Apple, not unlike Google, others. So what's Netflix gaming? And of course, you know, is Apple going to welcome it with open arms, or is this going to be another issue to be resolved later?
Yeah, I mean, that's the problem with the App Store at the moment. Every story is just about some crazy clash of App Store policy, because now that the door's open for change, every company is just trying to push the boundary, right, to see what they can eke out. To be fair to Netflix, in this case, I don't think they're going to have a problem. What they've launched on Android, they've started, you know, they're dipping the toes in the water of games as their streaming business kind of starts to peter off a little bit in terms of growth for video subscriptions, because they dominate the market. They're trying to expand into other entertainment categories. Games is an obvious one. What they've launched on Android this week is 5 games. You've got Stranger Things, the game. You've got Shooting Hoops. You've got Card Blast, and you've got Teeter Up. I mean, these games aren't top quality IP. They're not AAA titles. They're like basic games that... They're even more primitive than some Apple Arcade games, right? It's like stuff you'd find in the App Store, just riddled with ads, but Netflix is often for free. On Google, on Android this week, they're available, and you can download them as separate apps through the Google Play Store, and they're going to be like linked to from within the Netflix app itself starting this week. That's why I don't think there's going to be a problem when this comes to iOS. Netflix has said they intend to roll out to iOS, but they're not... Like, obviously, they're known as the streaming company, but these games are not streamed. It's not like xCloud or PS Now or whatever, you know, everyone else is doing in terms of the streaming game service. And that obviously annoyed Microsoft with xCloud early in the year. Netflix games, at least right now, are just apps that you download from the App Store. They just happen to come from Netflix. And when you launch them, you log in with your Netflix account to play them. And you have an ad-free experience. It's no extra charge. So under those rules... they can come into the App Store without a problem, because, you know, Apple, when everyone was complaining about Apple not allowing streaming game services on the store, Apple updated the rules to say you can have a streaming game service as long as each app is submitted as its own binary, as each individual listing in the App Store, and you basically log into each one. So this is basically that, except the games aren't streamed. They're just downloaded direct to the phone anyway. I think longer term, you know, over the span of many years, I think Netflix does want to move into like the stream market because if you do streaming games, you can basically get higher visual fidelity because you can render the games off-site and then just stream to the phone with good resolution. So I think Netflix is going to do it eventually, and at that time they might have more of a go-to-market issue with Apple, but near term, they're going to basically just buy rights to some mobile games, ship them to the App Store, you download them, maybe you see them in the Netflix app and you click on them, it just launches the App Store to download the app, you sign in with your Netflix account, and boom, you can play them. So short term, Netflix isn't going to have an issue here getting these games out. Maybe by the time they have, you know, AAA titles they want to do them over streaming, then they're going to hit the same problems that, you know, Microsoft and similar companies have had trying to actually launch that stuff, because asking a streaming game service that is adding games to its library almost on a daily basis to make individual apps for each one, that's just untenable. It's a stupid rule. Apple should change their mind on that, but according to the rules, Netflix is fine for now.
All right, and even more exciting is, you know, sort of what we alluded to earlier, which is iMac rumors for next year. And this is, you know, the update to the 27-inch iMac, which currently uses Intel. And this is the move to the M1 Pro and M1 Mac. So we've got some more details there. So what's new with that story this week, Mayo?
Yeah, so this is by Leaker Dylan on Twitter, who's proved very reliable so far this year. Interestingly, this is posed as like the update to the 27-inch iMac, but apparently it still has a 27-inch screen. So what we saw with the 24-inch iMac, obviously, is they took the iMac 21 kind of chassis and slimmed it down and redesigned it a bit, but made the bezel smaller, albeit the chin still being there, but the display bezels got a bit smaller to accommodate a 24-inch screen. At least according to these initial rumors, the iMac update is going to stay at 27 inches rather than going to like 30 or something, which I guess isn't completely unprecedented, because if you look at like what Apple did with the iPad Pro in 2018, you know, they made the 10.5-inch one, they took that to 11, but they had the 12.9-inch iPad Pro and they didn't make the screen even bigger. So, you know, they're not always necessarily going to make the screens bigger, these things, just when they shrink the bezels, but it felt like in this case it was kind of obvious thing to go to 30 inches, but apparently not. However, it is getting ProMotion 120 Hz. It's probably going to be the same mini LED panel that you see on the MacBook Pro, but obviously, you know, bigger. It will have an M1 Pro or an M1 Max chip. dark bezels, so not like the light bright colors that you see on the M1 iMac, but dark bezels. Apparently the overall design will look similar to the iMac 24 inch, so you're probably still going to have like the chin and stuff. No like notch or anything crazy like that. It's going to look like the 24 inch iMac, but bigger. You get HDMI, SD card slot, USB-C. You'll get Ethernet on the brick, just like with the M1 iMac. Face ID has been tested, but not confirmed to be included, so probably not. And it'll arrive sometime in the first half of 2022. This could be branded as an iMac Pro, but that's unclear. I think this machine might not be an iMac Pro just because the chips, if they're going to do M1 Pro and M1 Max in these chips, what we were kind of expecting, or what we're expecting for the Mac Pro, is basically like the M1 Max times 4. And we've been expecting for the higher-end iMac to have basically an M1 Max times 2. And at least according to this leak, it's the same internals as the MacBook Pros that have just come out. So maybe this is just like a 27-inch iMac, and then they do a higher-end model down the road. Or maybe they're not even going to bother having like another iMac Pro again, and they just assume that the iMac's good enough unless you want to pay for the extra to jump up to, you know, Mac Pro-level performance.
Yeah, that makes sense. Either way, we know that we've got between now and, what, September, October, for this M transition from Intel to Apple Silicon to be complete, based on the last update from Tim Cook. So
yeah,
plenty to fill out the year with that.
Yeah, and practically the Mac Pro will be the last one, right? Because it's so low volume. I think what's going to happen is you'll have the higher end Mac Mini ship with M1 Pro and M1 Max chips. You have this iMac update come within the first, like, maybe by the spring, right? And then at WWDC in June, they'll tease the Mac Pro update, and that'll ship by the end of the year. And then Apple will be completing the transition. And then, obviously, while that's concurrently to that, they'll start iterating on all their other machines, i.e. the M2 MacBook Air, etc., etc. I can't wait to see this machine, but when I was seeing this rumor and thinking about you, I was thinking, you know, you're probably not as keen on this just because I feel like you'd want, like, a bigger screen and stuff, you know? Like, 27-inch iMac is cool, but if you want to be getting like the iMac Pro, I feel like you want more performance than what you get out of the current laptops, and you'd want like, you know, like a 30-inch screen or a 32-inch screen or something cool like that.
Yeah, man, I'm really like as of this week, because it changes, of course, but based on what's available. But it sure would be nice if Apple made a display that was like the design of the current iMacs minus the Chen, because you wouldn't need the Chen part. It would just be, you know, in the case of the current 24-inch iMac, the white bezel part, because there's no computer inside, and that is where the computer is in the chin. That'd be very nice, something like that that could attach, you know, over Thunderbolt or USB-C to the current iMac or the notebooks. So that's my current. I mean, it's been so long, but that's what everyone has wanted, and I'm pushing that, you know, because the iMacs, again, like these are going to be very expensive. And I'm happy with like the iMac 24 inch as a display and like, you know, desktop computer, the performance is enough for me. I think like the only thing I'd expand is just to put a Thunderbolt dock with it, so I'd get more ports than just the two. Mm-hmm. And I was gonna say earlier, has there been I don't think there has been HDMI on an iMac before, and so
I don't think so.
It's on the Mac Mini, but that's because there's no display. So this would be, I think, the first time for an iMac.
Yep.
To have HDMI, so that'll be interesting just as a change in the lineup. But the screen stuff, I mean, what I love about the crazy $6,000 display is the nanotexture option, and the fact that it rotates to portrait orientation and the OS recognizes that. Like, those are two cool things I like about it. Right now you can get that nanotexture in the 27-inch Intel iMac in a version that isn't as expensive as the standalone Pro Display XDR. I assume that will carry over with this next iMac that's rumored, because it's not on the 24-inch iMac. But those are the things that I'm really interested in, and it's less about the computer inside at this point, because I'm pretty, you know, well off content with what's in the, you know, below $2,000 lineup.
Yeah, like, out of this rumor, I think all of it's probably true, but I would be surprised if it does only have, like, if they're not going to have a higher-end iMac option. I don't think they're going to just put the M1 Pro and the M1 Max that you get from the laptops in this. Maybe that's, like, the base model spec, and then at the higher end, you can get, like, the rumored M1 Max times 2, essentially, because an iMac is big enough in terms of chassis in it and heatsink and stuff that it should be able to accommodate a bigger chip. So maybe that's just a matter of timing, and, like, this update's coming at the beginning of the year, and they'll have an M1 Max times 2 version coming later in the year. That'll be funny to see what they end up naming that chip, because they've kind of used Pro Max up, so what they're going to call like a 2X Max or a 4X Max, who knows? Well, Apple naming is always hilarious, but yeah, I think the rest of this, the fact that it's going to look like the 24-inch iMac with the bezels and the chin, like, we predicted that when the M1 iMac came out, like, that's just their style they're going for, and as much as I'd like a chinless design, you're not going to get it with this generation. But yeah, I think we'll see this in the first half of the year, and then if either the part about the chip is wrong or slightly incorrect, or there'll be another iMac by the end of the year that has the slightly higher performance characteristics. Finally this week, Happy Hour is brought to you by Survivor. 9to5Mac and Survivor have teamed up to give away the iPhone 13 Pro to one of our listeners. Survivor's new case collection for the iPhone 13 lineup is designed to be used alongside MagSafe chargers and accessories. Survivor's lineup for iPhone 13 offers up to 20 feet of drop protection using their shock-absorbing design. And the entire case collection is made from recycled materials, so you're protecting more than just your phone. Survivor's antimicrobial materials prevent up to 99% of bacteria, and they won't wash off or wear down from everyday use. Survivor also offers a textured grip to provide a more secure hold on your device, and it has a raised bezel, a raised lip, to protect the screen and camera from surface-level scratches. That's the new case collection from Survivor. Head to Verizon stores to check out the entire new collection for your iPhone 13 and iPhone 13 Pro. And special thanks to Survivor for sponsoring the show, and be sure to check out the link in the show notes for the giveaway on 9to5Mac to win an iPhone 13 Pro. Thanks again to Survivor Cases for sponsoring the show.
Okay, and finally, Apple has a new podcast that does not have an RSS feed, but then it does have an RSS feed, and it's not connected to Apple TV, but who knows, maybe Apple TV could become a thing after this podcast as well. What is the Hooked podcast, Mayo?
Yeah, so it's true in essence that this is their first standalone original podcast. It's called Hooked. It's about a true story of a man called Tony Hathaway, who was like a successful man in his career, but then he was led astray by an opioid addiction. He was prescribed over the counter drugs, and it basically led him down into the perils of addiction and eventually a career in bank robbery. Previous like Apple original podcasts have all been connected to TV Plus properties, right? So you've got like the companion shows, like For All Mankind companion podcast, Foundation companion podcast, the Jon Stewart show has a podcast of the same name. And then you also got stuff like The Line, which is a podcast docuseries that aired in the spring of this year. But when they announced that, they at the same time said, oh, a TV Plus documentary series is also coming later in the year. And that's actually coming out on November 19th. So maybe the same day my laptop arrives, just coincidentally. That's when that's coming out. But this is Apple's like first standalone announcement, at least, because the podcast is Hooked. The first three episodes are available now inside of Apple Podcasts, or there's an RSS feed if you can find it. And then they're doing the rest of the episodes weekly. I think it's a 9-part series in total. New episodes on Wednesdays. But at least so far, this doesn't have a association with TV Plus at all, but it is actually published by Apple TV Plus. So all of Apple's podcasts are getting released by Apple TV Plus in name. And I think basically what they're going to do from now on is that they're going to probably have a few more of these original podcasts. And they're basically testing the waters in terms of audience reception. So if a decent number, and who knows what the actual like numbers are expected to be, but if they reach their targets of listenership, then they'll feel that it's worth developing a TV series out of it, because obviously producing a podcast is way cheaper than producing a TV show. So that's why these are kind of under like the Apple TV Plus banner, even though this podcast has no TV component at all right now. It's basically a way for Apple to keep the licensing rights up front rather than having to pay off someone a lot of money down the road. Like, you know, a lot of Apple shows are based on podcasts, like the Shrink Next Door. That was a podcast, and that's coming out as an Apple TV Plus series next week. But to get the rights for that, they have to pay like the Wondery people who published the original show a lot of money. So I think Apple's trying to flip that on its head, produce its own podcasts that they think maybe have TV show potential. If the podcasts are successful, then they can order them to series. So that's kind of what's going on here. It's kind of confusing, obviously, at the moment, because you have like Apple TV Plus releasing a podcast that has no video component at all. But basically the idea is that it's possible that a television adaptation is announced down the road. I mean, the podcast sounds fun, but to be honest, I wouldn't listen to it. I'd rather wait for it to become a TV show and then I can like binge it in one go. I don't know about you.
Yeah, I was just thinking, podcasting under the Apple TV umbrella just reminds me of TV under the Apple Music umbrella. You know, it's where do you put the hobby kind of. But what else is coming? So we've got a few more things. So Swagger. What is Swagger?
Yeah, Swagger's that started last week. The first three episodes. It's basically just like a basketball drama. This is on Apple TV Plus now. It's a drama series that's based around youth basketball, and it's like executive produced by Kevin Durant. I watched the first three episodes. I thought it was pretty good, so I'm kind of onto that at the moment. And then tomorrow they have their next like big feature film, which is the film sci-fi film Finch, starring Tom Hanks. Greyhound, obviously they bought Greyhound off Sony Pictures last year, and that became like their biggest original film to date, because obviously, you know, it's got the Tom Hanks factor. And now a little over a year later, they've again bought a movie that was intended for theatrical, this time from Universal, and it's exclusive on TV Plus streaming tomorrow. And of course, again, it features Tom Hanks. It's Tom Hanks, a robot and a dog, like classic Tom Hanks movie concept. But apparently it's getting good reviews, and so I think it'll be popular. Like anything with Tom Hanks in it is pretty popular. So that's their like next big film release, and that'll be out basically as you listen to this.
Yeah, I was in a hotel over the weekend and I saw on TV, on like local TV, an ad for this movie on Apple TV Plus. And it was, you know, it's like a movie trailer, but then it says on Apple TV, and then it says coming, it's available soon. It didn't give a release date. So I guess the ad was cut before they knew, but oh well. So Apple TV Plus stuff. Anything else for the week on anything?
It's the Apple TV Plus 2-year anniversary, but
yeah.
I don't have anything more substantial to say about that at the moment. Maybe we'll talk about it in a future week. Like I am guest appearing on Sigmund Judge's podcast this week. If you want to hear a little bit about The Tragedy of Macbeth, that's an Apple original film that's releasing early next year. Me and Sigmund got to see it at a London Film Festival, which is quite fun. So if you want to hear about that, you can tune into his podcast as well to hear me talk about that for 20 minutes.
Ah, cool. Next week, I'll expect to have, actually over this weekend, spend some time with the Apple Watch Series 7 in both sizes. I received the 41mm on loan from Apple, and that's the smaller of the two sizes. And I purchased the 45mm. So I think I sent you a picture of both on my wrist, and kind of my hunch was, is the 41mm, you know, being the smallest now, is that kind of in ballpark of the 42mm, which used to be the big size of the two? And I kind of felt like, yeah, like this, if this were the only watch size, it wouldn't feel like it were, you know, the quote unquote dainty watch on my wrist, in that, you know, a while ago, the 38mm would have. So, but I expect to just, you know, spend some time over the weekend and, you know, mainly just get some pretty pictures and size comparisons. So, because that's mostly what the Series 7 is, right? Is the way it looks. And, that's its story. So, and then next week, if there's anything, you know, interesting that I think of there, we'll talk about that as well. But, yeah, I don't know if you can tell from me, a little bit tired this week. nothing wild happening this week either. So, that is the Happy Hour podcast, for the week. If you enjoy the podcast, you can subscribe. Listen ad-free on Apple Podcast for $4.99 a month, or was it $49.99 a year?
$49.99 a year.
Yeah, we appreciate those subscribers on Apple Podcast. You can also listen to the show for free, as you do, with ads. We appreciate anyone who supports our sponsors. If you have any feedback for the show, you can email us together at happyhour@9to5mac.com. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at ApolloZac. That's APOLLOZAC. And Benjamin, you're on Twitter at
BZA Mayo.
And we'll be back next week. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.